some sense, not completely, but with a goal in mind, an ultimate goal in mind. God's goal for all of history is that all things be summed up in Christ. That's what Paul says in Ephesians 1, verses 22 to 23. That God has given Christ as head over all things to the church, so that he may fill all in all. So everything is heading towards the ultimate goal of Christ and his church. And since Christ is both head and body, then God is summing up all of history in the church as well. So the church is part of that eschatological consummation, is what it's called. And according to St. Paul in 1 Corinthians 10, as I mentioned last week, his generation was the generation upon whom the ends of the ages had come. He says that specifically. This means that the 400-year intertestamental period was the preliminary period leading up to the ends of the ages. So that's why this period in history is so important. It's the culmination, 400-year culmination of God bringing his people to the coming of his Messiah. God so orchestrated events during this period so that the way could be prepared for the coming of his anointed one. We also briefly considered the political, cultural, and religious developments during this time. There was a shift of power base, remember, from east to west, from Persia in the east to Alexander and the Greeks in the west, especially by Alexander the Great. A Persian benevolent despotism was replaced with Greco-Roman pragmatism. Aramaic and Greek became more common in Palestine during this time. So there was a shift of language use. Remember Hebrew, the Jews mainly spoke Hebrew, but then Aramaic and Greek became more common in that region. And then there were the three main religious reformations during this time as well. Does anybody remember what the three main religious reformations were, or liturgical reformations were? There was one, the anti-idolatry movement in favor of a strict monotheism. Since the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, there was a concerted effort to do away with all idolatry in Israel. And there was a concerted effort towards a more strict monotheism. Not that that hadn't existed before, but there was a definite push in that direction. There was also, secondly, a shift from prophetic ministry to priestly rule. The priests were now in charge again, both civilly, that is politically, and in terms of worship, of course, and liturgy and things like that. So the 400-year intertestamental period, you saw a shift from prophetic ministry to priestly rule. Thirdly, there was a shift from centralized temple worship to synagogue worship, a decentralized approach to worship. And that was the synagogue, the creation of synagogues all over the place, really. In Alexandria and Egypt, there was lots of synagogues built there, all around Palestine, and even some think in Babylonia. I mean, synagogue worship became the norm. And finally, we considered the scope of the period. Does anybody remember the exact dates? 420 BC to what? The birth of Christ, right? 6 BC or 4 BC, depending on which scholar you appeal to. So roughly 400-year period from 420 to 6 BC. From the last Old Covenant canonical prophet, who was Malachi. Yep. He's the last writing prophet. To the last Old Covenant non-canonical prophet, who was John the Baptizer. That's right. Or if you look at him from another perspective, he's also the first New Covenant prophet, in a way, in a sense. And then we briefly looked at the dominant world powers. So we briefly discussed Persia, who reigned from, which was the world empire from 539 to 331 BC. And then Greece, which reigned from 331 to 323 BC. So after Alexander died, you had these generals, essentially, who took over and divided Greece into four what are called satraps. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But there was Ptolemaic Egypt, which was essentially Greek, which led from 323 to 198 BC, and Seleucid Syria, which again was essentially Greek, from 198 to 166 BC. We're going to cover those four periods in this class time. So we're not going to get into the Hasmonean dynasty until next week, and then Rome up to the birth of Christ. So let's take a closer look now at this 400-year period. We're going to consider many of the political and religious details during this period. So there's going to be a lot of names and dates thrown around. So you're just going to have to track with me. If you have any questions or if you're getting lost, just raise your hand and hopefully I can help you out there. But just keep in mind, these shouldn't get in our way of seeing the bigger picture. What's the big picture here? And this has been said a few times now. What's the big idea? To Jesus, that's right. It's always about Jesus, right? God was preparing the world scene for the coming of his Messiah. So, let's begin with the Persian Empire, which actually goes all the way back to 539 BC. In 539 BC, Cyrus the Great defeated the Babylonians and allowed the dispersed nations, including the Jews, to return to their homeland. And we know this from the end of 2 Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah. Those books detail these events. The Jews returned under Zerubbabel in 538. I think it was about 25,000 Jews that returned with him in 538. And then under Ezra in 457, almost 100 years later, you have another return. And then Nehemiah came to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem in 444. So that's quite a long period there of returning from Babylon to rebuild Jerusalem and the walls and whatnot. There were 10 Persian kings during the Persian Empire. Obviously, Cyrus the Great was the first. Some of the more notable kings after him were his son, Cambyses, who conquered Egypt in 525 BC. There was Darius the Great. He was a little bit after Cambyses. He started the wars with the Greeks. So this is when the Greeks started to really kind of come up in the world scene. They started to attack some of the outposts of the Persian Empire and, you know, wanted to gain some dominance. So it was under Darius the Great's rule that the Greeks started rearing their heads. There was Xerxes, also known as Ahasuerus, who is mentioned in the Book of Esther. He's the king in the Book of Esther. He was the king of Persia during the infamous battles of Thermopylae and of Salamis around 480 BC. What recent movies have tried to depict those two events? 300! That's right. We will fight in the dark. So, though that king was, Xerxes was the king during that period when the Greeks were under attack by the Persians. Persians were trying to overthrow their, you know, the up and coming Greeks. And then there was Artaxerxes the First. He was the Greek. The Greek Athenians were becoming more powerful and extending into Persian Egypt. And this was during the time Artaxerxes the First was the king under whom Nehemiah was the cupbearer or the prime minister. And Ezra was his liaison for Jewish affairs. You can look at Ezra chapter 7 to fill yourself in on that. And then you have the period of Persian decline. So Persia lasted about 110 years, and then you have the period of Persian decline. This was a fairly uneventful period for the Jews in Palestine. Again, they were relatively unmolested by the Persians. The Persians were a benevolent despotism, so they pretty much left them to themselves to worship and even conduct some of their own political affairs during this period. But then Darius II came. He was the last Persian king mentioned in the Old Testament. He's mentioned in Nehemiah 12:22. And then Darius III. He was the last Persian king. He ruled from 336 to 331. And he lost the Battle of Issus to Alexander the Great in 333. And this marks the beginning of the Greek Empire. So, Inner Greek Empire, stage left. Philip of Macedon was the original aspiring Greek emperor of the world. He was Alexander's father. But he was murdered while conspiring to conquer the Persian Empire and Hellenize the whole world. So he wanted to conquer the world and Hellenize it. You guys know what Hellenize means? Greek. Greekanize. That's right. Speak Greek. enculturate them in Greek culture, philosophy, the arts, all of that. It's all encompassing. He wanted to Greekify the world. He managed to unite some of the Greek city-states into what was called the Hellenic League. Then Philip's son, who was called Alexander III, otherwise known as Alexander the Great, was only 20 years old when he took the throne. 20 years old. And he's the emperor of the world. You should never let a 20-year-old be the emperor of the world. He was tutored by the philosopher Aristotle. Aristotle was his tutor. He took poets, city planners, anthropologists, biologists, and musicians on his world-conquering campaign. It was like a circus show, I guess. I mean, he took all these people along with him because he knew if he was going to spread Greek culture everywhere, he had to bring these, you know, intellects and scholars and musicians, all these guys with him to establish Greek culture wherever he went. In fact, he's often referred to as the apostle of Hellenism. So he saw himself as the apostle of Greek culture. So, having set the stage, world empire stage, let's look now at Jerusalem and see what's going on in Jerusalem during the time of Alexander the Great. So Alexander swiftly conquered Phoenicia and the city of Tyre. I'm sure you guys have heard about that, right? Where he built the bridge, the land bridge from the mainland out to the island of Tyre and conquered the Phoenicians finally. And that was it. He was now world emperor. He moved south and conquered Gaza, which didn't put up much of a fight. You guys know where the Gaza Strip is in Palestine there. It's basically, you know, northern Israel, I believe. Or is it southern Israel? I can't remember. And then came to Jerusalem. So he actually came into the city itself. And according to Josephus' Antiquities, and you guys know who Josephus was. He was an ancient Jewish historian. He wrote about Alexander coming into Jerusalem. He says Alexander demanded that his statue be placed in the temple. So Alexander wanted a statue of himself put up in the temple. Now, we're going to see in a little bit where this did actually happen. It didn't happen. The Jews said, no way, we're not putting your statue up in this temple. You know, we'll put it outside the city or somewhere, but we're not going to put it up in the temple. That would be high-handed rebellion against Yahweh. Jaddua, who was the high priest at the time, told him that this wasn't going to happen. But he promised Alexander that all the priests of the temple that year would name their newborn sons Alexander. All right, let's compromise a little bit here. We're not going to build you a statue, but we'll name our sons Alexander. This really kind of began the Hellenization of Jerusalem. This is when Greek pagan influence really started to come into Jerusalem itself. I mean, there had been other minor influences, but this was kind of the headwaters. There's another story about Alexander's time in Jerusalem, which gives the account of Alexander offering sacrifices to Yahweh in the temple under the direction of Jaddua. Now, scholars obviously debate this point. Some secular scholars say, no way, this is apocryphal. He didn't do this. But, I mean, you have ancient historians who attest to this. I think Josephus mentions this in his Antiquities. So that's a pretty big deal. The world emperor Alexander the Great would come into Jerusalem and offer sacrifices to Yahweh under the direction of Jaddua. Other conquerors would come in and offer, you know, try to offer sacrifices to their own gods, and you know, and we'll see how this plays out later, especially with Antiochus the Fourth. I do too. I think it happened. Believed in Yahweh. Yeah. Yep. I'm going to appease these Jews. Yep. Yep. Exactly. It was a shrewd political move on Alexander's part, at the very least. Now, whether or not he actually converted and became a God-fearing Yahwehite, a Gentile, I don't know. God knows. So, In this account, Jaddua also showed Alexander how he was prophesied in the book of Daniel to be the one to conquer the Persian Empire. So the high priest Jaddua pulls out the book of Daniel and points Alexander to Daniel 8, chapter 8, verses 5 to 7, which I'll read to you. It says, this is Daniel speaking, obviously, "While I was observing, behold, a male goat was coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground." In other words, he was swift, swift as wind. "And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. And he came up to the ram that had the two horns." And we'll go on in a minute to Daniel interprets the goat and the ram, but just for now, follow along. "And he came up to the ram that had the two horns, which I had seen standing in front of the canal, and rushed at him in his mighty wrath. And I saw him come beside the ram, and he was enraged at him, and he struck the ram and shattered his two horns. And the ram had no strength to withstand him. So he hurled him to the ground and trampled on him, and there was none to rescue the ram from his power. Then the male goat magnified himself exceedingly. But as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken, and in its place there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven." Now, without any interpretation at all, that sounds very similar to what happened when Alexander came in and conquered Persia and then died, and the four generals succeeded him. But Daniel gives us more information. In verses 20 to 21, Daniel says this: "The ram which you saw with the two horns represents the kings of Media and Persia. And the shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece. And the large horn that is between his eyes is the first king." So Alexander was the first official king of Greece. Well, not official. He was the first Greek emperor of the world. I should put it that way. So I think there's a pretty good case could be made that, you know, Daniel is talking about Alexander the Great and him coming in and conquering Persia. And Alexander accepted this interpretation and granted the Jews' request that Jews everywhere be allowed to live according to their ancestral laws and be exempt from paying tribute every sabbatical year. So Alexander actually accepted this interpretation and said, "Oh, okay, well, you guys seem friendly." And I like that. I like that story. That's a good story. That's all about me and how I'm going to conquer the world. So you guys don't have to pay taxes now. So after the death of Alexander, he died at the age of 32 due to alcohol poisoning and venereal diseases. Yeah, he's a pretty profligate ruler, which probably tells us something about his faith or lack thereof. The Greek Empire was divided into more than 20 satrapies. A satrap was basically a local governor. So after the death of Alexander, all these generals and commanders and, you know, people of high and mighty renown stepped up, and you had 20 satrapies all over the empire. And again, a satrapy is a local government, a local regional governor with their own, you know, ruling power. There was plenty of infighting between these factions, but there were four main successors that came out of this, four main generals, essentially, who succeeded Alexander and, for the most part, ruled back and forth. I mean, there was constant fighting, but Antigonus was one, Ptolemy, Seleucus, and Cassander were the four main successors to Alexander. And for about the next 150 years, that is from 323 to 166 BC, there was no shortage of political unrest and intrigue between these men and their successors. You know, they just kept fighting back and forth over who's the big boss, who's going to take over Alexander's place, and so on. Essentially, there was a power struggle between these dynasties for the next 260 years until the conquest by Rome in 63 BC. So, you know, depending on which historian you read, some historians say, well, the Ptolemies were world rulers for a while, and then the Seleucids, and then Rome. I'm not sure if I agree with that assessment. Yeah, I don't think there was any one world superpower. Well, Greeks were still in control for the most part. But in terms of one emperor like Alexander, you don't see it. The Ptolemies were constantly fighting with the Seleucids over who had major control, who had final control. It wasn't until Rome steps in 63 BC that you see finally a one world ruler again, at least in my assessment. So, again, let's look at some of the Jerusalem highlights during this period. That is from the period of Alexander the Great's death in 323 BC to 198 BC, about 200 BC. So about 125 years. There are some pretty significant events that occurred in Jerusalem during this time. Although there was major infighting between the Greek factions during this time, the Ptolemaic dynasty maintained a relative dominance over the other satrap dynasties. So while the Ptolemies had relative dominion over the empire, the Jews remained comparatively unmolested, with some very important exceptions. There were some exceptions to that, but by and large, the Ptolemies gave the Jews the same kind of freedom that Alexander the Great gave them. And so a lot of the Jews, and especially the high priests and the Sanhedrin, the officials in Jerusalem, appreciated that, and so really, you know, liked the Ptolemaic dynasty. They liked those guys. They were left to themselves in the sense that Judea remained under the leadership of the high priest, as in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah. The annual payment of tax to the crown was made by the high priest from his own resources. So he didn't have to dip into the temple treasury to pay taxes. He just paid it out of his own pocket, apparently. Judea was treated as a sacerdotal province under the leadership of the high priest. So lots of freedom, politically, relatively speaking, lots of freedom politically and liturgically or ritually. Now, having said that, they were molested, if you will, in a sense. Jerusalem was captured in 312 BC by a joint campaign of the Ptolemies and the Seleucids on the Sabbath. They figured, well, the Jews aren't going to fight back on the Sabbath, so we're going to go in on the Sabbath and take over Jerusalem. And they did. However, they did not slaughter anyone. They didn't massacre, as far as we know. It was a good takeover, if you will. It was a kinder, friendlier takeover. Nobody was massacred. They didn't try to set up a statue of Zeus or anything like that in the temple. But they did send thousands of Jews. They exported them to Alexandria in Egypt. And this is kind of a sideline to where we're at. But these Jews that were exported to Alexandria in Egypt flourished in Egypt, in Alexandria. They built synagogues all over the place. And so they were trying to Yahwehize, or, you know, they were proselytes too. They were, they were evangelists. They were trying to, you know, turn Alexandria into a new Jerusalem, if you will. So they were Jews on mission. They built synagogues everywhere, worshipped in the synagogues. It was in Alexandria that the Septuagint was translated. You guys know what the Septuagint is? The Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament? Pretty significant, isn't it? What's that? Yep, 72 translators. That might be a myth. We don't know if 72 was exactly the number of translators. But it was done in Alexandria. And there's all kinds of myths and legends around it, of course. Some of the... exporting them. Some of the, you know, when the conquering kings would take over a city, they'd get rid of a lot of the natural strong people. Yeah, especially the elite. They'd get them out of there and put them somewhere else so they wouldn't have much influence in the city. You know, that happened with the first, when the Babylonians came in. The first guys they took out were Daniel, and I believe the high priests, the aristocracy in Jerusalem. So kind of a common political and military tactic in that day. So the Septuagint was translated around 250 BC to 200 BC. And the reason they translated it is because you had so many Greeks, so many Gentiles in Alexandria who were either Jewish by birth and just never really learned the Hebrew language or Aramaic, but spoke Greek as their first language. And then you had a lot of converts, God-fearing Gentiles, coming into the synagogues, and they needed a way to teach these people. So they translated the Hebrew Bible into Greek. That's the Septuagint. And I think that's the most practical explanation. I mean, there's all kinds of crazy myths and legends about why they did it and who did it. You know, angels came down and translated it for them. I think it was a very practical, it's like during the Reformation. Why did Tyndale and those guys translate the Bible into English? Well, you got a lot of English-speaking people that need to learn about God. So that was essentially why they translated the Septuagint. So that took place from 250 to 200 BC, about 50 years of translation to translate the Hebrew Bible. They started with the Torah, obviously the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, and they finally finished the entire Old Testament by 200 BC. And the other thing to note, too, about Alexandria, this was the hub. This was like the Harvard or the Yale of its day. This is where all the scholars would come from all around the world to philosophize and, do their astrology and look at the stars and, think big thoughts. So, it's pretty amazing that God used this city to translate the Bible into a common tongue. Remember, Greek was one of the most common languages in this day. So, these scholars would come into Alexandria and I think essentially learn about God, learn about Yahweh, learn about his ways. There's a great paper I recommend reading, actually, by Peter Lighthart called Did Plato Read Moses? He wrote a paper called Did Plato Read Moses? And he literally argues that Plato read Moses, especially based on some of the accounts we have of Alexandria and the philosophers who were influenced by that city and came to that city and spoke and wrote there. It was a huge library there that scholars from all around the world would come and read from. Now, going back to the year 312 BC, remember that's the year that Jerusalem was captured by the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. This marks the beginning of serious Hellenistic influence in Palestine. I know I mentioned Alexander the Great already. That was a really significant shift for Jerusalem. But now, 312 BC marks the beginning of serious, and you'll see how serious it gets, Hellenistic influence in Palestine. Most Jewish historians of that day and for quite a while thereafter use the year 312 as the beginning of the Common Era. They wanted to start the calendar over on 312 BC. That's how influenced they were by Greek philosophy and history and things like that. They wanted to start a new calendar. Before this, and even since then, a lot of Jews start with creation. And we'll add up the genealogies. Creation is day one, I guess. Add up the genealogies, and that's how you date the eras of the world. That's how you get your calendar. Well, 312 BC, a lot of the Jews who'd been Hellenized in Jerusalem wanted to start over. So from about 300 to 200 BC, various Jewish movements arose which sought to further this Hellenizing agenda. And remember, starting over with the calendar is just one way to do that. I mean, French Revolution, remember, they tried to do it then. Start over, day one was the first day they were going to inaugurate of the French Revolution. And that's a way that pagans, unbelievers, try to take over. It's by saying, well, the calendar begins now. This is the day of new beginnings. And these Jewish capitulators knew that. There was a specific family in Jerusalem, the Tobiad family, was the most notable of those who wanted to Hellenize Jewish culture. So you have Jews in Jerusalem, aristocratic families like the Tobiads who want to Hellenize Jerusalem. And providentially, you got Jews in Alexandria who want to Jewishize want to basically Yahwehize Alexandria. So you see how God's moving these different pieces on the chessboard here? The Tobiads were a wealthy aristocratic family in Jerusalem who later became the notorious Sadducees of Jesus' day. So you want to know where the Sadducees came from in Jesus' day. Remember the Sadducees? They're the ones most influenced by Greek philosophy. They didn't believe in the immortality of the soul. They didn't believe in angels. They didn't believe in life after death. You know, they were basically the materialist philosophers of their day in some respects. And the Tobiads were the original Sadducees. Joseph Tobiad, specifically, is one example of a traitor to the Jews. His uncle, the high priest Onias II, who was the high priest during this period, refused to pay tribute tax to Ptolemy IV. So the high priest Onias II finally said, look, we're done paying taxes to this pagan king. So Joseph Tobiad went to Alexandria and bid for the appointment of being Jerusalem's first tax farmer or tax gatherer. So you read about, you know, in Matthew or in the Gospels, you read about how much hatred the Jews have for the tax gatherers. Well, this is where it stems from. This guy was the first tax gatherer who went to Alexandria and said, hey, I'll go and get those taxes from those Jews so you can get your money. Now, towards the end of this period, around 200 BC, there was a major power shift amongst the Greek satrap dynasties. The Seleucids gained the upper hand over the Ptolemies in 198 BC. So remember, have these power struggles going back and forth between these Greek generals. And finally, the Seleucids take over in 198 BC. The first Seleucid king during this time was Antiochus III, who granted the Jews freedom of worship. So he continued the Ptolemaic policy of giving the Jews much freedom in worship. He let them complete and maintain the temple. He exempted the priests from taxes. And the people of Jerusalem were exempted one-third of their taxes. I think, wow, that'd be kind of nice, get one-third of my taxes exempted. So God providentially gave his people about 25 more years of freedom in the realms of cultus and culture, in worship and in political and cultural life. Then, his third son, Antiochus IV, ascends to power. And everything God's people had been given and worked for was about to be taken away. So this guy, Antiochus IV, was one bad dude. He really hated the Jews. He hated them for everything they stood for. Other kings before him thought of themselves as gods in some way, so that wasn't new. You know, pagan kings always thought of themselves as incarnate gods or whatever in some way, shape, or form. But Antiochus IV really took this to another level. He wanted everyone, everywhere, to worship him as the manifestation, hence the title and his name, Epiphanes. Epiphanes means literally the manifested one. He wanted everyone to worship him as the manifestation of the Olympian Zeus. He thought he was Zeus incarnate. His royal title was Theos Epiphanes, literally God manifested. His enemies, though, referred to him as Epimenes. Literally, that means madman or insane one. You know, they made fun of him because they knew he wasn't really God incarnate. So in Jerusalem at this time, there was a struggle over the high priesthood between Onias III, who was obviously a descendant of Onias II, who we previously mentioned, and his brother Joshua, a.k.a. Jason. Remember, at this time, Jews had a thing for renaming themselves Greek names. So if you were a Joshua, you'd rename yourself Jason, because that's more Greek. It's, you know, a way to Hellenize yourself. Onias was pro-Ptolemaic, because remember, the Ptolemies were fairly liberal about giving the Jews their freedom to worship, and even in some political matters. But Joshua was pro-Seleucid. Joshua was another Tobiad who wanted to Hellenize Jewish culture. So he had someone steal from the temple treasury and then made it look as if Onias was the culprit. So he set up Onias, the high priest, as the culprit of this theft. Riots broke out all in Jerusalem, and Onias set off for Antioch to protest his innocence. While Onias was gone, his pro-Hellenist brother, Joshua, bribed Antiochus IV to receive the office of high priest. So he turns to Antiochus IV and says, "Hey, I'll give you a little more money if you'll make me the high priest." Antiochus granted this to him, and Joshua then proceeded to build a Greek gymnasium in Jerusalem. And you got to understand how scandalous that was to the Jews. The Greek gymnasium wasn't exactly like, you know, LA Fitness here, you know, or some fitness gym you might be a member of. The Greeks, when they worked out naked. They worked out naked. And that was highly scandalous to the Jews. The Jews were like, "No, we're not going to work out naked with a bunch of uncircumcised pagans." So he built this gymnasium in Jerusalem and even went so far as to rename Jerusalem the New Antioch. Yeah, pretty scandalous indeed. As with all traitors, though, and their treacherous ways, Joshua himself was scandalized by his close friend, Menelaus. Menelaus managed to outbribe Joshua for the position of high priest. So he came up with even more money than Joshua had. Said, "Hey, why don't you make me the high priest? I'll pay a larger sum," and he did. So Antiochus, you know, being the man of great integrity that he was, took the bribe, and Menelaus then went on to murder Onias III, who was a faithful high priest in Jerusalem in that day, and all the Orthodox leaders who opposed him. Then he transferred the temple treasury to Antiochus IV. So, as you can see, we're seeing a huge insurgence of Greek control, power, thought, influence in Jerusalem at this point. As you can imagine, this did not sit well with the faithful Jews. So we're building up to a major war here. Enter stage left, the Hasidim. You guys familiar with the Hasidic Jews in New York? This is where they come from. The Hasidim came about at this point. They were, literally, Hasidim means the pious ones. This group of faithful Jewish leaders began to mobilize in reaction to the Hellenizing tendencies of Joshua and especially Menelaus. So, what happens next? Antiochus IV and the Great Persecution. So this is where the Jews come under pretty severe persecution, trial, tribulation. If you read 1st and 2nd Maccabees, you guys ever read that in the Apocrypha? You know, it describes a lot of these events in gory detail. It's kind of like reading Fox's Book of Martyrs when you read it. But from 168 to 167 B.C., the Jews came under the mighty wrath of Antiochus IV. Here are some highlights of that time. Joshua and the Hasidim had expelled Menelaus, so they got rid of him, finally. They knew how bad he was. But Antiochus, in a rage and embarrassed to keep Jerusalem, well, he was enraged and embarrassed because, you know, his new high priest that had just bought his way into the high priesthood had been kicked out. He wanted to keep Jerusalem under his power, so he attacked Jerusalem on the Sabbath. This was a common theme with a lot of these would-be emperors. You know, they would often attack the Jews on the Sabbath because they knew the Sabbath was a holy day and the Jews wouldn't fight back. So he attacked the Jews, Jerusalem, on the Sabbath. He managed to destroy the city walls and enter Jerusalem in 167 B.C. 80,000 Jews were summarily massacred. I mean, that is a holocaust. 80,000 Jews were summarily massacred, just killed, slaughtered right on the spot. I think in 70 A.D., some historians think there was, I think, upwards of 2 million Jews in Jerusalem when Titus came in and finally slaughtered a bunch of them. But I don't even think Titus had the kind of enmity towards the Jews that Antiochus IV had. He really hated the Jews. He ordered the cultic Hellenization of all Palestine by outlawing. He full-on outlawed the Sabbath, circumcision, Jewish ceremonies and sacrifices, and even the Torah itself. I mean, no other pagan king had ever even come close to doing that. And here he's outlawing all these things that obviously the Jews hold so near and dear. I mean, it'd be like Obama coming in and saying, you know, you can't worship on Sunday. You got to shut the doors to your church. You can't educate your kids in a Christian education. You can't read your Bibles anymore. You can't have communion. I mean, it was that bad. So then he conducted orgies in the temple and set up cultic prostitution for his soldiers. So he set up cultic prostitutes in the temple that his soldiers would, you know. He sacrificed swine on the altar of burnt offering in the temple and ordered the Jews to eat the meat. That's pretty bad. I mean, you know, that's like adding insult to injury now. And then, so it gets worse. That wasn't even the worst of it. On December 25th, which in the Jewish calendar was Kislev, the month of Kislev. On December 25th, he erected an altar or statue of Zeus Dionysius, which probably had his own image on it, in the temple area. We're not exactly sure if it was in the Holy of Holies or in the outer temple or just in the courtyard. It didn't matter. I mean, the Jews still, you know, saw it as a high-handed act of treason against Yahweh, against the God of heaven and earth. This is mentioned in Daniel 11:31 as the abomination that causes desolation. So I think that's what Daniel's referring to in Daniel 11. It's the abomination that causes desolation. And the man who was guilty of that was Antiochus the IV. You know, once he set up that statue, that altar to Dionysus, every hell broke loose, literally. The Jews, oh, go ahead. Did you have a question? Yeah. So why didn't he drop dead?
Right.
Yep. So remember, play out in history. Well, that's a good question. And I was thinking that same thing, too. Well, why didn't he drop dead? You know, he's in the presence of the Holy Father. Well, remember, Ichabod? Yeah. God has left, remember? So God had left Jerusalem before the destruction of the temple by the Babylonians in 586 BC. So God had departed the temple. And there is no record anywhere throughout from that point through the intertestamental period, even up in Jesus' day, of the Shekinah glory coming back into the temple. So it wasn't just, you know, we think Alexander the Great probably took a peek in the Holy of Holies. It's like, well, I don't see anything. Ptolemy, do you guys remember Ptolemy? Was he Greek or Roman? I can't remember. He did the same thing. He was like, well, I've heard a lot of stories about this Holy of Holies place, and I'd like to take a peek. He went in there, took a peek, and nothing happened. And there's no account. We don't have. In fact, the Jews were pretty. In fact, there are accounts of the rabbis during the intertestamental period, saying, look, you know, the Shekinah glory has departed and has never come back. And they were waiting for the Shekinah glory to come back after post-586. So during this whole, which you could call the intertestamental period, although it's, you know, we're looking at 400, the birth of Christ. So the Shekinah glory never came back, as far as we know. There was no, manifestation of God's presence in terms of the Shekinah glory or the theophanic glory cloud, however you want to call it, above the mercy seat in the Holy of Holies. And the Jews recognized this during this period, and they were waiting for Yahweh to return. They were actually waiting for the Shekinah glory to come back. And but he did. Jesus. Jesus was the new Shekinah glory, God manifest in the flesh. And they missed him.
Okay, so
yes. Yeah, because it was still considered a house of prayer. The temple was still, you know, highly regarded. Obviously, the Jews and Jesus himself had high regard for the temple while it was still around. But, you know, I mean, this gets into some, you know, controversial theological issues. So I don't know if I should address these things. But depending on how you view the covenant and covenant continuity, discontinuity, those kinds of things, that all affects how you view the temple. and its importance in the life of God's people. Okay, so the temple was finally, and I would argue, will never be built again, finally destroyed in 70 AD. I don't think the temple's ever going to be built again. I think the opportunity was there for Lord Balfour when he flew in with his special forces agents in, you know, was that 1948? You know, was that the six-year, what war was that? Do you know what I'm talking about? The English special forces guys rappelled in on Temple Mount where the mosque is. And he was dispensational too. He had all the opportunity to say, yep, we're going to tear down this mosque and we're going to build a new temple, third temple right here. And he didn't. And you kind of wonder why. You know, that would have been a perfect opportunity, you know. It subdued all the, you know, the enemies of Israel, if you will. And, you know, he was a dispensationalist. I mean, he was waiting for a third temple to be built eventually. And he didn't, and he could have. So why not? Well, I don't think the temple's ever going to be rebuilt because the church is the new temple, basically. We are the temple of God. So there's no more need for physical building temple like the Jews had. There's no more need for those sacrifices. Christ was the last sacrifice. It's his blood that was shed that covers our sins, atones for our sins. So that stuff is no longer needed. There's been a transition, a final break from the old covenant to the new covenant. And that's it. So what we're going to discuss next week is the war. So finally the Jews had had enough of this uncircumcised pagan oppression and revelry, and there was a lot of it. And I haven't even touched the surface of it. I mean, we got the meat of it, but I mean, there's all kinds of accounts and stories I wish we could get into. You got to read 1st and 2nd Maccabees to see just how bad the persecution was. I don't want to get too gory, but you know, there's a mother with seven sons. There's an account of a mother, a Jewish mother, with seven sons. And she was brought up before Antiochus the IV, I think it was Antiochus, and he made her watch them brutally slay all of her sons, from oldest to youngest, and it was brutal. And she still wouldn't recant. She still wouldn't confess Antiochus as God, and they ended up killing her as well. And there's all kinds of stories like that in 1st and 2nd Maccabees. If you want to familiarize yourself with that, I would recommend you read those two. They aren't very long books either. Those two books in the Apocrypha. So the Jews had finally had enough, and then they brought what came about was what's called the Maccabean Revolt. And we'll get into this next week. The Maccabean Revolt was the final uprising of the Jews against their pagan oppressors. And this, Lord willing, is where we will pick up next week. And it's a wonderful story, a war like the Lord of the Rings type, you know, war. Okay, so we are in 168. So Antiochus Epiphanes brought about the major persecution from 168 to 167 B.C. He set up his altar statue on December 25th. We have an exact date, 167 B.C. That was the final straw. Now the Jews are going to assemble their forces. We're going to get the Maccabean Revolt involved, and we're going to see some pretty crazy stuff next week.